Chapter 13. Disaster. On November 11, 1975, the day of Angolan independence, a small force of 1,500 men altogether, FNLA, the Zairean 7th and 4th Battalions, and 100 Portuguese Angolan commandos, moved cautiously across the wide, flat Kifangando Valley, 20 kilometers from Luanda. The advancing column was supported by a dozen small armored cars and half as many jeep-mounted 106 recoilless rifles. The four South African 5.5-inch artillery pieces were emplaced on the ridge behind, manned by South African artillerymen. A few kilometers back, the two North Korean 130-millimeter long-barrel cannon were located where they could place their devastating shells at any point on the road from Kifangando to Luanda itself. CIA and South African advisors watched the column's movement across the valley. Morale was high. The soldiers had confidence in their officers and in each other, for they had recently met and routed the MPLA in several small encounters. From the ridge behind, they had seen the fuel storage tanks on the outskirts of Luanda. Every soldier thought hungrily of the city, which lay almost within his grasp. Roberto, a man obsessed with his place in history, saw the goal of a lifetime struggle just beyond the next ridge, beyond a few MPLA soldiers and some Cubans. In Luanda, the Portuguese High Commissioner had fled without ceremony, and frightened MPLA leaders peremptorily celebrated Angolan independence, declaring the People's Republic of Angola. Conspicuously absent were the representatives of 40 African nations, who should have been present to celebrate the end of 500 years of Portuguese tyranny in Africa. 100 miles southeast of Luanda, the South African armored column was having a field day, covering vast distances so rapidly the Cuban MPLA forces had difficulty retreating ahead of them. At CIA headquarters in Langley, the Angolan task force celebrated Angolan Independence Day with a late afternoon party, decorating its offices with crepe paper and serving wine and cheese. People came from all over the building, from the Portuguese task force, the French desk, and the special operations group, to drink to the program's continued success. Then the Cubans' 122-millimeter rockets began to land in the Kifangando Valley, not like single claps of thunder, but in salvos, 20 at a time. The first salvo went long, screaming over the heads of bewildered FNLA soldiers and shattering the valley with a horrendous, ear-splitting sound. The next salvo was short, and the little army was bracketed, exposed in an open valley, without cover. Soldiers' hearts burst with a clutching terror as they dived to the ground or stood helplessly mesmerized, watching the next salvo land in their midst, and the next, and the next. CIA observers on a ridge behind estimated that 2,000 rockets rained on the task force as it broke and fled in panic, scattering across the valley in aimless flight, abandoning weapons, vehicles, and wounded comrades alike. Survivors would call it Inshila Walufu, Death Road. As for the artillery, one of the North Korean 130-millimeter cannon exploded the first time it was fired, killing its Zairean crew. The second misfired, injuring its crew. Both guns were permanently out of action. The obsolete South African cannon pounded away, but their firepower was a fraction of the rocket salvos, and their range scarcely over half that of the 122. If they did bring the truck-mounted 122-millimeter rocket launchers under fire, the latter quickly displaced, resuming their fire from prepared positions nearby. There was no pursuit and no engagement of troops units by the MPLA. But for the FNLA and Zairians, the war was virtually over. Thereafter, whenever the MPLA Cuban force got close enough to lob a few 122-millimeter rockets into their ranks, a panicky retreat took place to the next town or port. Disciplined troops can, of course, cope with such shelling, as the Viet Cong did with American bombing throughout years of war, by means of foxholes and tunnels, controlled withdrawals and counterattacks. But the FNLA guerrillas and Mobutu's commandos were not diggers. By the second week after Kifengondo, they were a demoralized, undisciplined rabble, out of control of their officers. The rate of their retreat was governed solely by the MPLA Cuban advance, which was slow and methodical. Kinshasa Station described Ambriz, the FNLA logistics base 70 miles from Luanda, as in, quote, a stable state of panic, unquote. A month later, in mid-December, the MPLA closed on Ambriz, and the FNLA fled north, relocating its headquarters in the ancient Congo capital of São Salvador, near the Zairean border. The Zairean troops, Mobutu's finest, vented their frustration on the villages and towns in the path of their flight, in a tidal wave of terrorism, rape, and pillage, until the Congo tribesmen of northern Angola prayed for the early arrival of the MPLA and Cuban liberators. Meanwhile, in November and December, the South African UNITA armies continued to sweep north toward Luanda and east along the railroad. On November 14th, the primary South African column captured Porto Amboim, 100 miles down the coast from Luanda. A second South African column began to move toward Malange, encountering Cuban regular army troops with more sophisticated weapons, including missile-firing helicopters, T-34 tanks, and 122-millimeter cannon, which had a 26-kilometer range and were considerably more accurate than the 122-millimeter rocket. In a battle at Sela on December 17th, the South Africans outmaneuvered the cannon, knocked out the tanks, and killed scores of MPLA soldiers. A huge store of captured Russian arms was displayed to journalists in Luso, while the third South African column pressed eastward, still attempting to open the railroad to Zaire. The rout of the FNLA and Zairians at Kifengondo was a disappointment but not a shock to the working group. By then, the managers of IA Feature were realizing the scope of the Soviet-Cuban commitment in Angola. Soviet expenditures were estimated as high as $225 million by late November. Ours had not yet reached $25 million. The Soviets had sent 7 shiploads to our 1, 100 plane loads to our 9. Footnote: eventually, we mounted a total of 29 C-141 flights, the last one arriving in Kinshasa, January 29th, 1976. End footnote. Thousands of Cuban soldiers were arriving, and we had photographic evidence that they had the larger T-54 tanks. In a penny ante war, the Soviets had opened their wallets and put real money on the table. Competitive juices stirred in Washington, and the no-win rationale was dropped at all levels. Ambassador Mulcahy flew to Kinshasa to reassure Mobutu of our determination and full support. The National Security Council ordered the CIA to outline a program which could win the war. Sophisticated weapons were now discussed freely. Red-eye ground-to-air missiles, anti-tank missiles, heavy artillery, tactical air support, C-47 gun platforms. The working group considered major escalations: the formal introduction of American advisors, the use of American army units, a show of the fleet off Luanda, and the feasibility of making an overt military feint at Cuba itself to force Castro to recall his troops and defend the home island. There was a thread of unreality, of wishful thinking in these discussions. The gap between Henry Kissinger's egotistical desire to win and the limits of his power in the real world became apparent. In July 1975, Director Colby had warned that it would take a $100 million program to be sure of winning. This was probably high. In August, my trip had revealed that a sophisticated weapon system, such as a C-47 gunship costing $200,000, would have shattered the MPLA forces. By December, however, because of the massive Soviet-Cuban buildup, we would be coming from behind, even with a $100 million effort. On the task force, we labored through several nights to produce a new options paper, which offered a choice of 30, 60, or $100 million programs. They included armor, artillery, tactical aircraft, a C-130 aircraft, and 1,000 mercenaries. But the National Security Council was stymied. The CIA Contingency Reserve Fund was depleted, and no more secret funds were available. Further escalations could be financed only with congressional approval, and the Congress was not cooperative. The administration attempted unsuccessfully to borrow $28 million from the Department of Defense budget. The CIA's last $7 million reserves were committed to keep our effort alive while desperate measures were considered. These combined circumstances, the lack of funds and an uncooperative Congress, may have saved our nation from a tragic escalation in Angola, another Vietnam. The $30, $60, $100 million options would have plunged us in deeper without reversing the situation. We did not have 1,000 mercenaries to send to Angola. And even if we had, 1,000 undisciplined adventurers would have accomplished little against 10,000 organized Cuban regular army troops. Under great pressure to pull a magic ace out of a losing hand, the CIA decided to use part of the $7 million to recruit the 20 Frenchmen and 300 Portuguese mercenaries. It was a senseless gesture, but something at least to report to the 40 Committee. And we requested approval to place American advisors in Angola. Incredibly, Henry Kissinger, having ordered us to assure our allies of our full support, having ordered us to seek every means to escalate the Angolan conflict, could not be bothered to focus on the situation. He grunted and went to China. Inside the CIA, in November and December, we buckled down and worked ever harder, as though the speed with which we answered cables and produced memos for the working group could vindicate our ineptness on the battlefield. Potts became obsessed with the program, swinging into work on his crutches in the gray chill of the autumn pre-dawn, his mind brimming with desperate plans for the program. His safes were finally locked hours after dark, when he would slowly make his way down the southwest steps, his face still locked in concentration. His secretary would remain another 2 hours at her desk, sorting, typing, and filing his paperwork. The task force kept the same pace. Saturdays, Sundays, and holidays blended into Mondays and Fridays. Case officers in the field responded with a comparable effort. Kinshasa continued a barrage of suggestions to headquarters to escalate the war. Mine Luanda Harbor. Use United States submarines to interdict shipping. Introduce American personnel. Airdrop firecrackers. Every CIA station involved in the conflict urged official cooperation with the South Africans and devised joint operations which would tempt headquarters into escalating CIA involvement with them. The Kinshasa station, especially, promoted joint South African activities, and its officers flew to South Africa to discuss the possibilities. The Kinshasa station urgently recommended that a U.S. Air Force C-141 be provided to fly 6 additional 25-pounder cannon with crews from South Africa to Kinshasa for use in northern Angola, stating that it was, quote, very much in favor of retaining to the fullest extent possible South African involvement, end quote. It received a frustrated turndown from headquarters. Undaunted, Kinshasa relayed urgent South African requests for fuel, for more sophisticated weapons, air support, and trucks. Then it reported a South African plan to fly a task force into southern Zaire to attack Tejera da Sousa from the border. Kinshasa station was encouraged in its policy toward the South Africans by cables from the CIA stations in Lusaka and Pretoria. The French contributed more ammunition and 4 Alouette missile-firing helicopters, which U.S. Air Force C-141 airplanes hauled to Kinshasa in early January. Without pilots or ground crews, they were useless, and the CIA desperately sought mercenaries who might fly them. We also negotiated with the U.S. Air Force for a C-130 to support the helicopters at the Angolan battlefronts. The CIA actually intended to deliver these helicopters and the U.S. Air Force C-130 to the South Africans, despite United States policy against such military collaboration. The French were to be mere intermediaries. But time ran out, and the South Africans withdrew before pilots and crews could be located. In November, a security officer hand-carried a report from Kinshasa to headquarters, charging that the immoral personal conduct and the insecure operations of CIA personnel in Kinshasa were an embarrassment to the United States chargé d'affaires. Such a report from a security officer would normally carry some weight, but once again the agency's lack of an effective inspector general was exposed, as the DDO and director took no disciplinary action. The program was 4 months old, and TDY officers began rotating back from the field, bringing with them anecdotes and personal accounts of the things that don't get written into official cables, the human side of IA feature. There was one marriage between a records officer and a reports officer. Other returnees never spoke to each other again. One young officer was eager to get back to Angola, having decided that he would smuggle home a handful of diamonds on the next mission. About this time, St. Martin requested approval to put his wife on a contract to help Ray Childs write propaganda articles for the newspapers. Mrs. St. Martin, it was said, was bored, and her low morale was becoming a problem. Agency regulations strictly forbade such nepotism, and station chiefs, especially supergrades, are prohibited from putting their families on the government payroll. However, a contract was approved for St. Martin's wife to write for the Kinshasa station, on the basis of a special dispensation from Colby himself. Carl Bantam, the Africa Division deputy chief, took his first orientation trip to Africa in December, visiting Kinshasa, Pretoria, and Lusaka. He left determined to perform his historic role as enforcer, to bring St. Martin down to earth. He returned, strangely silent about the trip. Later I learned that St. Martin had hosted a dinner in his house for Carl and selected personnel of the IA feature program. This group, under St. Martin's leadership, had literally shouted Bantam down when he attempted to bring them into line and explain the limitations of our charter in Angola. Now St. Martin was the chief of station, on his own turf, reporting to Potts. Carl Bantam, although a GS-17, was only a staff officer, not in the chain of command. Paul Foster came back from his second TDY to Kinshasa just before Christmas. His natural confidence was buoyed even higher, because he now could pronounce the names and knew where places were on the map. He briefed the working group and gave a fascinating account of the Battle of Kifangando, which apparently he had watched from the ridge. "We taught them how to build bunkers and advised them to spread out. It did no good," he said. At the word advised, the working group members looked at each other knowingly. The National Security Council had said there should be no American advisers in Angola, but they had nevertheless suspected that the CIA was cheating on that caveat. Now they knew. Footnote. By this time, of course, the National Security Council was urgently seeking the means for escalation and was scarcely inclined to reprimand the CIA for its aggressiveness. End footnote. With all else failing, the CIA turned to its mercenary recruitment programs with renewed determination. Already underway, the recruitment of the French hoods was proceeding slowly. The CIA station in Paris had fine rapport but little influence with the French service, and could not seem to expedite that program. The French service insisted that the CIA work directly with Bob Denard, who was doing the recruiting. Denard was himself a famous mercenary. He had fought for Mobutu in the Congo, in a program financed by the CIA, and had later defied Mobutu, been wounded, and convalesced in Rhodesia in 1967. In November 1967, he had brought 16 mercenaries on bicycles across the Angolan border into the Katanga province of the Congo, and bluffed his way 300 kilometers against Mobutu's commandos to the outskirts of the huge Kolwezi copper mines, apparently hoping that the Katangese gendarmes would rise up under his leadership. At Kolwezi, however, Mobutu's commandos made a stand, which checked Dinard's advance and forced his withdrawal back across the border. Since that time, Dinard had lived in France, performing useful services for any intelligence service or government that paid cash, playing all ends against his bank account. The CIA had reports that in the fall of 1975, Dinard, now back in Mobutu's good graces, had recruited mercenaries to support Mobutu's invasion of Cabinda and to run an operation in the Comoro Islands. I was opposed to all mercenary operations, but this one was at least more palatable than the others. The Frenchmen would be white neocolonials, but not as offensive to Africans as the Portuguese, and the sponsorship of the French service reduced the likelihood of psychopaths and sadists. The contract called for technicians and skilled military veterans. Bob Dinard was to handle all the recruiting activities, and only he would meet with a CIA representative. The French service would facilitate passports and visas. UNITA representatives would house the men as they staged through Kinshasa, and Savimbi would supervise their activities in Angola. This arrangement gave the CIA plausible denial of involvement in the operation and protected the United States government from claims that might be lodged by the families of any mercenaries killed in Angola. A paramilitary officer, who was a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps Reserves and had for years managed an air proprietary company in Africa, was sent to Paris. I was satisfied with his selection, although I wondered if he would be a match for Dinard in working out the terms of the contract. At the outset of the program, the French intelligence crowd had taken General Walters for $250,000, and our station in Paris had consistently been outmaneuvered by the French. I expected Dinard would manage to obtain very favorable terms for himself and his men. Even my cynical projections did not steel me for the demands that came by cable from the Paris station on November 24th. Dinard agreed to field 20 men for 5 months for $350,000 cash and would deliver them to Kinshasa 10 to 30 days after the entire $350,000 was deposited to his Luxembourg bank account. He expected us to give him the entire sum before he began his recruiting efforts. I read the Paris cable in the morning, but made little comment at staff meeting. No doubt Dinard would eventually get the full $350,000. The agency never bargains hard in dealing with agents, and Potts was desperate to place the mercenaries in action. It never entered my mind that we would agree to pay the mercenaries in advance. Other things involved me during the day, and only late that evening did I find on my desk a cable written by the support office authorizing immediate payment of the $350,000. Potts wasn't in. I took it across the hall to Carl Bantam's office and confronted him with it. "Carl," I said, "possibly you don't understand about mercenaries. Their code is money, and their only loyalty is to money. There aren't half a dozen in the world who can be paid in advance and still fulfill their contracts when it's hot and dirty and the rockets start landing on the battlefield. With mercenaries, you pay as they perform, not before." He argued that this situation was different because the French had recommended Dinard. "So? We know Dinard as well as they do," I said. "But that is beside the point. This is business, and it doesn't make sense. It's unthinkable for the CIA to pay him in advance." I held my ground and personally tore up the cable. Instead, we sent out a reply suggesting that we should make a lesser deposit against Dinard's recruiting expenses and pay the remainder in increments as the operation developed. A cable shot right back from Paris, energetically relaying Dinard's arguments that he had been burned once before, when Mobutu had diverted CIA funds and failed to meet his payrolls. Now he would only work with cash in advance. Once again I balked. This time Dinard was working directly with a CIA case officer, and we could crack the whip at him by asking the French to intervene. Nevertheless, Potts, making reference to mercenary honor and professional codes, authorized payment of 50% immediately, and the remainder when the first mercenaries boarded planes in Paris bound for Kinshasa. The total had been increased to $425,000 to include life insurance for the 20 men. Eventually, it would be increased again to $500,000. The first 11 hoods arrived in Kinshasa January 10th, and for 2 days were trained by CIA weapons experts in the use of the SA-7 ground-to-air missile. Then they were flown to Silva Porto in IA Feature airplanes. The remainder went into Angola on January 27th. One of them was obviously a French agent. Our Portuguese mercenary program received even less enthusiastic support from me. The black Angolans had just won a bloody 15-year struggle against the Portuguese. To ally ourselves with the same Portuguese losers, especially when the Soviets were represented in Angola by popular Cuban revolutionaries, was the height of foolishness. Nor could we expect our Portuguese force to stand against the Cuban juggernaut that was forming. The Portuguese recruitment program nevertheless moved forward. A CIA case officer met Colonel Castro in Madrid in early December, and with the help of an interpreter working in hotel rooms, began to hammer out a program for the recruitment of 300 men. First, Colonel Castro opened a bank account to which the CIA finance office in Bern deposited $55,000 for operating expenses. And then Avery gave him another $55,000 in untraceable cash. They signed an agreement, approved by headquarters, in which Colonel Castro agreed to recruit, pay, and direct the 300 Angolan, refugee, Portuguese commandos to fight alongside the FNLA in Angola. Colonel Castro would be reimbursed for all recruiting expenses, 300 round-trip plane tickets to Kinshasa, salaries and bonuses, maintenance in Angola, and medical expenses, up to a grand total of $1.5 million. The contract obliged the men to fight in Angola for 5 months. The monthly salary scale was for 198 privates, $500 each. For 80 sergeants, $650 each. For 15 second lieutenants, $800 each. For 3 first lieutenants, $1,000 each. For 3 captains, $1,400 each. And for 1 major, $2,500. The gross monthly salary would be $172,700, or $863,500 for 5 months. An additional monthly separation allowance would be paid at the rate of $100 per wife and $50 for each child, grossing $60,000 per month, or $300,000 for 5 months. Travel was estimated at $200,000. Medical costs, $50,000. Bonuses, $100,000. And subsistence, $75,000. Colonel Castro himself would receive a commission of $25,000, plus whatever other benefits he squeezed out of the rest of the budget. The recruiting began slowly. Too slowly, it seemed, to CIA officers who were watching the FNLA fleeing in northern Angola. We had believed Castro's early claims that he had 600 men waiting for his call. As weeks went by, he explained with some embarrassment that it was difficult to work effectively over the Christmas holidays, and he had to develop the infrastructure to put together the small army. When Castro wanted additional funds, we balked. Demanding to see a list of names of the recruits and an accounting of how the $110,000 had been expended. Castro argued that he had been promised a free hand and was obligated by the contract only to deliver 300 men to Kinshasa. We backed down about the accounting, and Castro eventually provided the names of a few dozen recruits. The first man, a sergeant, arrived in Kinshasa January 1, 1976, followed by 12 others on January 28th. By then, the FNLA was collapsing across the border, and Castro was told to suspend the recruiting. The 13 men were returned to Europe without seeing Angola. Simultaneously, a third mercenary force of about 150 British and Americans was being assembled by Roberto himself. No memos were written about this program at CIA headquarters, and no cables went out approving it. Since it overlapped extensively with our other activities, however, we became increasingly concerned at headquarters. IA feature airplanes were carrying these fighters into Angola. They were being armed with IA feature weapons. Their leaders met with CIA officers at IA feature safe houses in Kinshasa to discuss strategy and receive aerial photographs and briefings. It seemed likely Roberto was using CIA funds to hire them. Two Englishmen, Nick Hall and a Dr. Bedford, had been recruiting for Roberto in England as early as October 1975. By late December, their mercenaries were trickling into Kinshasa and Angola. In January, over 100 Englishmen were fighting for the FNLA in northern Angola. Their quality was exceptionally low. Some had no previous military training. In two cases, London street sweepers were recruited directly from their jobs and dispatched to Angola. In New York, Florida, and California, adventurers and publicity seekers began grandstanding. One American named Bufkin was appearing on American television, claiming to be a CIA agent and to have fought in Korea and Vietnam. He contacted Roberto and then flew to Kinshasa, where he paraded about the Continental Hotel in a paracommando uniform with empty holsters on each hip. A half dozen Americans joined the British mercenaries in Angola. Among them were some serious, though misguided, individuals. A young father of four, Daniel F. Gearhart from Kensington, Maryland, answered the call. A highly respected former CIA paramilitary officer, George Bacon III, joined him. Neither would return alive. Our nervousness about the publicity and exposure these mercenaries were getting led to requests that Kinshasa Station provide an accounting of how IA feature funds were being used by Roberto. Were the mercenaries on the CIA payroll? Kinshasa replied that it was difficult to get an accounting from Roberto. In fact, we had written the IA feature project, so accountings would not be required. However, it was confirmed that the Englishmen were being paid new $100 bills, just like those we were using to fund Roberto. Beginning in December 1976, headquarters began to get, we thought, a better feeling for these mercenaries through operational cables from Kinshasa. Agency officers flying in and out of northern Angola took note of an Englishman named George Cullen, also known as Costa Georgiou, who had somehow become Roberto's field general in Angola. Kinshasa, reporting favorably on his activities, wanted to recruit him as an in-place observer of the fighting. He was fit and aggressive, it was reported. Almost single-handedly, he had ambushed and routed a small MPLA column near Ngagi. Cullen, a native of Leeds, England, had been a British paracommando, then a mercenary in Oman. He spoke Greek, Arabic, English, and some Portuguese. Altogether, a good man, it seemed. Only days later, Cullen seemed much less of a good thing. Incredible tales concerning him began filtering out of the war zone. Cullen was beating up blacks. Cullen was murdering blacks. Cullen had stripped, beaten, and humiliated Zairean officers. Cullen was a psychopath. On February 1, 1976, a mobile patrol of 25 mercenaries went on a reconnaissance operation near San Salvador. On the way back, they attacked a forward defense post of their own men, mistaking their colleagues for Cubans and a little Panhard armored car for a T-34 tank. Then they fled to San Salvador. 2 days later, Cullen, having tracked them down, lined 14 of the malefactors beside the road and gunned the whole lot down. Stripping their bodies, he left them in the sun as an example to others and disappeared in the bush. 2 days after that, Roberto went to San Salvador with three mercenaries, including a Brit named Peter McLeese and an unidentified American, to deal with Cullen. They were met at the airstrip by two mercenaries, one of them Cullen's sidekick. McLeese smashed one with a rifle butt, then stripped them both to the waist and marched them into town, their hands over their heads. After a summary court-martial, the sidekick was found guilty of participating in the execution of the 14. On the spot, he was dealt the same fate. A few days later, 15 other mercenaries commandeered a plane and flew to Kinshasa, armed and angry, not at their comrade's execution, but because they had not been paid. They were seeking Roberto to take what they could by force. Fortunately, they were met at the airport by a CIA officer who reasoned with them and gave reassurances, until they relinquished their weapons and calmed down. Mobutu, always concerned for his own safety, kept aggressive police and paracommando battalions in Kinshasa. He was particularly sensitive about mercenaries, who on previous occasions had not only rebelled against him, but had also occupied the eastern provincial capital of Bukavu. Whites are generally welcome in Kinshasa, but they do not wisely go about brandishing weapons. Had this band of mutineers blustered into downtown Kinshasa with a show of arms, almost certainly a slaughter would have ensued. As for George Cullen, he was captured by the MPLA. 3 months later, he was tried and executed in Luanda.